This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening on September 12th. Our show this evening is going to contain segments including the Montrose Counseling Center. Sally Huffer will be here, and she'll be talking about the things they are doing to help the people from the hurricane relief area. Also, Kelly McCann will be here. She's the new CEO of the AIDS Foundation in Houston. In the second hour, we're going to be talking to the Women's Course and what they're getting together to have a wonderful course. Also, the Gay and Lesbian Latin Organization will be here talking about their new organization. But first, to London.
BBC News with Zoe Diamond. The director of the United States Federal Emergency Agency, Michael Brown, has resigned after being heavily criticized for his handling of relief efforts following Hurricane Katrina 2 weeks ago. He said his decision to step down was in the best interests of President Bush and the agency. Mr. Bush, who is visiting the region, acknowledged that mistakes had been made in the relief effort, but he again rejected suggestions that the response was slow because so many of the victims were poor and Black.
The storm didn't discriminate, and neither will the recovery effort. When those Coast Guard choppers, many of whom were first on the scene, were pulling people off roofs, they didn't check the color of a person's skin. They wanted to save lives.
Aid agencies estimate that huge numbers of children have died because of the food crisis in Niger. The French organization Médecins Sans Frontières says the death rate is several times over the international emergency level. It's criticized aid agencies for giving help to those who are moderately undernourished rather than to the most needy. Our correspondent Hilary Anderson is in Niger.
The latest figures on deaths caused by the food crisis in Niger are alarming. A new study concludes that on average, more than 40 young children a day have been dying in the one area that's been surveyed in the east of the country. That means that over recent months, thousands have probably died of hunger. The doctors' organization, Médecins Sans Frontières, has criticized international aid organizations for failing to direct specialized food aid to those in the most extreme stages of starvation. The World Food Programme says most of the food that is needed is in place, but that it's not yet been distributed to at least 1 million people.
The German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder and his challenger have clashed in a television debate ahead of the general election on Sunday. There were heated exchanges as the Chancellor attacked the opposition Christian Democrats' plans for tax reform, denouncing them as completely unfair. Mrs. Merkel accused Mr. Schroeder of trying to scare voters into supporting his Social Democratic Party. You're listening to the news from the BBC. Norway's centre-right Prime Minister Kjell Munge Bondevik has admitted defeat in his country's parliamentary elections. Mr. Bondevik said he would inform the Norwegian King on Tuesday that he would resign in October. The leader of the opposition Labour Party, Jens Stoltenberg, said he would try to form a government with the socialist left and centre parties. There's been a third consecutive night of violence in the capital of Northern Ireland, Belfast. Protestant or loyalist demonstrators threw petrol bombs and stones at the police, set fire to cars and set up roadblocks, severely disrupting traffic in the city. Earlier, the British minister responsible for Northern Ireland, Peter Hayne, told politicians and community leaders in the province that they must support the forces of law and order. John Thorne reports from Belfast.
So far, no loyalist political leader has taken up the Northern Ireland Secretary's challenge to view what he termed the horrific police video footage of Saturday's petrol bombers and paramilitary gunmen, and then still argue that the violence was not an orchestrated attempt to murder police officers. The general response from the Orange Order and other representatives of the Protestant communities continues to place the blame on the government's neglect of loyalist alienation and resentment. Tonight in Belfast, there are reports of blast bombs and petrol bombs being thrown in the north and west of the city. But at the moment, nothing to reach the scale of the disturbances on Saturday and Sunday.
Scientists at the American space agency NASA say one of their satellites has picked up a flash of light from the edge of the visible universe from what they think is a star that exploded thousands of millions of years ago. They believe it can provide crucial insights about our universe when it was very young. With more details, here's our science correspondent Roland Pease.
The light detected by NASA's SWIFT satellite started its journey around 12.5 billion years ago, when the universe was still incredibly young and long, long before our sun or home planet existed. The mere fact the flash could be seen at all proves that the source must have been incredibly bright. Astronomers say there was more energy in the brief flash than the sun will put out in its entire lifetime. Explosions of this sort, called gamma-ray bursts, are thought to come from exploding stars. This one will cause great excitement among astronomers because it will have come from one of the universe's earliest stars.
Electricity supplies have been restored in the American city of Los Angeles after some of its most famous areas were hit by a widespread power cut. That's the latest BBC News.
This is Queer Voices. And what would we think?
We would think it's time now for Queer Voices. And this is Jack Belinsky.
And J.D. Doyle.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
On tonight's show, we have a number of things, including shortly, Sally Huffer will be here talking about what is going on at the Montrose Counseling Center and what they are doing to help people who were affected by the hurricane.
Yeah, as people may have heard last week when Larry Bonneries, as we like to say, was on talking about his experience leaving New Orleans and what has happened there and the effort and partnership that he got going with the Pride Committee and with Jack and the Counseling Center and the partnership that has taken place so that there is special effort for the GLBT community, and so that there are services available and networking. And I know people all over the country who said, what can we do? I have sent them out. Okay, here's a website you can go to, pridehouston.org, and you can help directly help the GLBT community
in
Houston.
Basically, all the Pride Committee is doing is helping raise the funds, helping get the word out. Montrose Counseling Center is doing all the work.
You're just funneling the funds.
Right. We are doing that because...
In a clean and honest way, it's not one of those soprano things.
Right. All the money that is being raised is going directly to the Montrose Counseling Center, and the only reason that we're doing this is because we had the ability to do it with the recognition of our website around the country, and also the fact that Larry Bonneries was part of Pride years before, and we're a 501c3 that he knows of, and we could get it done quickly.
Right. And then the community center, the Houston Gay and Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center is also doing work, and one of the things that they're doing is to try to raise funds so that when they rebuild in New Orleans, that the community center there will be supported.
Then Kelly McCann is going to be here, and she's going to be talking about the AIDS Foundation Houston. She has been newly appointed to the CEO position. In the second hour, we have the Women's Chorus.
Well, not the whole chorus.
Well,
I don't know, because, you know, they never let me know who it was going to be. So
well, that would be a nice surprise. Yeah,
they might be ready to perform. I think they have their next meeting tomorrow night, and that's why they wanted to be on tonight, so they could promote that.
And then the Gay and Lesbian Latino Organization, it's a new organization. They'll have some representatives here, so we'll be able to talk about what's going on with their organization. But first, before we go that, I understand yesterday that there was a letter published in the L.A. Times by Bill Maher asking the president to resign over his,
Yay! Well, good idea.
I believe that not only the president but the vice president should resign also for their ineptness of what they did or didn't do, more than likely, with this emergency. The fact is that a good portion of the Louisiana National Guard was in Iraq with the equipment. That was one part of it, but the other part was it took them days to realize it, and in fact, I guess Michael Brown finally did resign today, but he should have been fired on the spot. Bush said he was doing great. great job a few days ago.
It's part of the same old, you know, culture of Bush, which he never admits that he's wrong. And if he had gone in there and said, I am sorry, we have messed up, let's, you know, roll up our sleeves and get to work. But, you know, I think it was just today was the first day that he actually was on the ground.
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans, seeing what has been going on. And
he's rounding up business for Halliburton.
Oh, that's right. He's got to see what they need.
You're right, and that's the other thing. I mean, he just pulled out the checkbook and wrote a check on this, and, you know, certainly there needs to be a lot of money spent to fix it, especially because of his mistakes. But that
there's some things that can't ever be fixed, though, because there are people dead because of him.
Right, right. And that a lot of that money will probably go to his friends in business who are going to make a lot of money out of this in a no-bid contest. So that we got that all out of our
system.
If you can stall for two more minutes, Sally Huffer is just walking in.
Okay. Well, it's always one thing about Sally, we can always count on her to come on and to talk about things that are going on in the community. Usually she's speaking on behalf of the Counseling Center, but they have so many programs going on over there that there's, you know, always something new to talk about. So we will forgive her for being a little delayed. So do we want to do news wrap or do we want to wait for Sally?
Well, we have no choice because Glenn's out of the control room.
Oh, well, he went to open the door to let Sally in.
We're on autopilot.
She's finding her way now, I believe.
Actually, let's do go to news.
Sorry, that wasn't Sally. That was somebody who just looked like her from a distance.
Well, then we'll go to news wrap.
Okay.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Arnold says he'll opta la veto California marriage equality, New Zealand elections prompt an ugly civil union backlash, and queer communities rally for Katrina relief. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 10th, 2005. The California State Assembly this week approved a bill to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. The state Senate had approved the same bill last week, so the Assembly vote made California's legislature the first in the United States to affirm marriage equality. But supporters' celebration was short-lived, as Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's spokesperson announced that he would veto the measure. The legislature will not override that veto, since both houses passed the bill on party-line votes with the minimum required in favor. The bill's sponsors have acted to delay its transmission to the governor for 2 weeks so its supporters can lobby him. But the veto is widely viewed as a political necessity for Schwarzenegger in order to retain his support among conservatives at a time when his popularity with other groups has been eroding. He needs the votes for a special election he arranged for November for measures that would weaken the legislature's control of state finances.
Referring to the ballot initiative Proposition 22, which defined marriage exclusively as between one man and one woman, and was approved by more than 60% of California voters in 2000, the governor's statement said in part, 5 years ago, the matter of same-sex marriage was placed before the people of California. We cannot have a system where the people vote and the legislature derails that vote. Out of respect for the will of the people, the governor will veto AB 849. Public opinion has shifted significantly on marriage equality in the 5 years since Proposition 22 was passed, with the latest California polling finding both support and opposition standing at 46%. Marriage equality activists deny that the current bill would unconstitutionally override Prop 22, which they interpret as having been designed to bar recognition of other states' marriages of same-gender couples rather than prohibiting them in California.
While the California marriage debate weighs on the relative powers of a voter-passed initiative and a legislative action, the Massachusetts marriage debate weighs a proposed ballot initiative against a judicial decision. This week, Massachusetts Attorney General Tom Riley, a Democrat, approved a petition for signature gathering towards asking voters whether to amend the state constitution to prohibit same-gender marriages. Riley believes the state constitution allows such a public move in response to what he considers to be a public policy decision by the state's highest court, which required the state to marry same-gender couples in a ruling on equality grounds that it went into effect last year.
But marriage equality activists were joined by two former Massachusetts attorneys general, among others, in maintaining that the state constitution prohibits referenda on judicial rulings. They say the section Riley cites does not apply to the Goodrich marriage decision because it did not overturn any existing law. Should the initiative sponsor, the Massachusetts Family Institute, succeed in gathering the necessary signatures to qualify it for the 2008 ballot, the legal group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders will challenge it in court on constitutional grounds.
California Governor Schwarzenegger already used his veto power this week to block a move against negative political campaigning based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The bill would have added those two categories to seven others already protected under a pledge in the Code of Fair Campaign Practices, which candidates for elective office adopt voluntarily. The governor apparently found the move unnecessary.
Lesbo was among the taunts shouted at New Zealand's non-gay Labour Prime Minister Helen Clark by the crowd at a nationally televised political debate. She accused National Party leader Don Brash of having purposely brought in what she called a mob of hooligans who chanted abuse every time I opened my mouth. National denied the charge, and it was actually not Brash, but a National Party board member who'd handed out their tickets to some of the party's Auckland volunteers. Labour has been particularly targeted by more conservative parties in this campaign for its enactment of civil unions with legal status equal to marriage that are open to gay and lesbian couples.
But it was learned this week that two mailers attacking Labour and its partner, the Green Party, in specifically anti-gay terms, did not come from a political party at all, but from members of the exclusive Brethren Church. That's somewhat surprising, since that church has generally been known to avoid politics as part of its isolation from most worldly pursuits. However, some literature campaigning against the move to marriage equality in Canada this year was also traced back to the Exclusive Brethren. The total world membership of this reclusive authoritarian sect is believed to be only about 27,000.
It was to protect Malaysia from having a gay prime minister that Anwar Ibrahim was fired as deputy prime minister, former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad told reporters this week. In 1998, Mahathir not only abruptly fired the popular Anwar from the cabinet and booted him from their political party, but saw to it that he was arrested for sodomy and related charges and remained imprisoned until a high court ruling freed him a year ago, after Mahathir himself had retired. Mahathir and the Malaysian justice system were harshly criticized by the international community for their handling of Anwar, whose health was ruined by his imprisonment and beatings. Mahathir said, "In our society, sodomy is not acceptable. Of course, among some media people, even they are gay. They don't like my taking action against a person for the kinds of things that they indulge in, so I became a bad guy because of that. But I cannot have a person who is like that in my cabinet, who may succeed and become prime minister. Imagine having a gay prime minister. Nobody would be safe."
Anwar, a devout Muslim who is married with children, has always denied all the charges against him, claiming a political conspiracy led by Mahathir. But it was only after his release that he criticized the law that had been used against him. While admitting that most Malaysians do not accept homosexuality, he said last year, "The question is, how do you use the law and intrude on people's privacy and their own private choices? This is the borderline. I think public display may be objectionable, but I think the laws need to be amended. The issue here is the invasion of privacy, and we have, therefore, to design and make sure the law does not involve the overzealous groups trying to push their views or values outside the scope of the law. So I think while I endorse the general law against homosexuality, I think it is against Islamic tenets and also the cultural practice here by most Malaysians. I think we have to bear in mind that invasion of privacy is something that we need to look at."
In Britain, the Liverpool City Council this week voted unanimously to develop a gay quarter modeled on Manchester's district. Councillors believe Liverpool has already been losing revenue as its lesbian-gay residents socialize in Manchester instead of at home. And they hope the city will be revitalized by new business opportunities that woo the so-called pink pound. First, the city will consult with its lesbian-gay community and with the bars that now serve them, which have not previously worked together. Liverpool councillors hope for a broad range of shops, services, and residential developments in their gay village, and will help to organize a gay business association to support them. They understand that for their project to succeed, lesbian gays must feel safe in the gay quarter in a way that many don't in Liverpool now. And the council is looking for their police to also follow Manchester's model of service and sensitivity to lesbian gays. Unlike most UK cities of its size, Liverpool has no annual Pride event.
And finally, one of the most poignant celebrations of lesbi-gay pride ever occurred this week in hurricane-devastated New Orleans. The city's 33rd annual Southern Decadence Parade had been expected to draw a crowd of 125,000 before the entire festival was canceled due to storm warnings. But the historically gay-friendly French Quarter, although seriously damaged, escaped the worst of Hurricane Katrina's winds and flooding, and a small number of its residents rejected evacuation orders to remain through the disaster. Determined to have their pride parade, about two dozen of those survivors found a bar's storm-tattered rainbow flag and marched behind it down Bourbon Street. Some even found the means to put together gaudy costumes and toss traditional Mardi Gras beads and confetti. Instead of blaring amplified music, there was a guitar and a tambourine. One carried a large sign asking, "Life goes on?" Among the New Orleans refugees, several hundred marched in what they called the unofficial Southern Decadence in Exile Parade in Lafayette, Louisiana. One contingent mocked government response to the hurricane by appearing as the Federal Emergency Mismanagement Agency.
Best News Wrap for the week ending September 10th, 2005. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Rick Watts.
This is Queer Voices.
Hi, this is Deborah Bell, and with us tonight is Kelly McCann, recently appointed as the Chief Executive Officer of the AIDS Foundation Houston. AIDS Foundation is something that's been around, unfortunately, since 1982, and was really created from the GLBT community. I was talking to Sue Lovell Friday, and she explained that how in other cities funding was made available when the AIDS crisis hit, but that didn't happen in Houston, and so we did it for ourselves. And that was part of what was the creation of the AIDS Foundation, which started off as the KS Foundation.
Well, and we should make a note, too, that Sue lost a brother very early on.
Right, right. Mm. And I think the same story that you have, Kelly, which is, you saw friends dying.
And sadly, I think that's the reason that so many of us that work in this field went into the field in the first place, is we saw personally, firsthand, the pain and the sheer horror of this illness. And so I think that a lot of us share that commonality. But you're right, Deborah. I think it's one of the things that makes me proudest of our gay community here is that they started the KS AIDS Foundation back in 1982. And, you know, really not just in Houston, but I think across the entire country, all of the services and the funds that are available now for those that are living with HIV and AIDS, it all began because of the work and the gay rights movement.
Well, and especially in the early days, it was sad because this was supposed to be the medical center of the world, and yet dealing with people with HIV and AIDS, we were very backward.
Well, and I think in the beginning, too, we saw a whole bunch of cases, primarily in New York and then some in the San Francisco and California area, and we didn't just recognize that it was going to be our turn in a very short amount of time, and so I think the government and some of those funds weren't made available to Texas because it was focused on the coasts, and so we did for ourselves.
Yeah, the third coast is usually the last coast.
Third and last, yeah.
Of course, we didn't even know what we were dealing with. It took a while to realize what was going on, and then it took a little longer for people to realize that it made no difference what your sexual orientation was, as far as AIDS, that it was something that is non-discriminatory in who it infects. Of course, we've learned a lot about how it infects and how to prevent that, which is part of the mission of the AIDS Foundation.
Absolutely, and that's where much of my passion lies, is in HIV prevention. And I just wanted to toss out one other thing, and I'll try not to get too controversial here. But, you know,
controversial?
I know, it's unheard of.
You're right.
But, you know, the fact that for so long there was a misconception that HIV was a gay disease is due in part to the media. But then I think we also have to credit our former President Ronald Reagan for failing to even say the word HIV or AIDS until we were years into this epidemic.
I'll never forget that newspaper picture of Irvashi Vaad standing up with a poster at a press conference where she confronted Reagan. And I can't even remember what the sign said. It might have been the numbers dead, and that he had never said, you know, and we would say, shame, shame, all
of
that.
I remember those days.
And we've come a long way. And in the beginning, what kind of services did the AIDS Foundation offer?
Well, you know,
we had to make it up as we went along.
Absolutely.
So.
This was totally uncharted territory.
What were some of the first things?
The reason that the AIDS Foundation was established was to provide supportive services, and frankly, it was to help people as they were dying, help them with buying groceries, personal care, taking care of their home, even visiting them in the hospital. In the beginning, it was an all-volunteer organization. It was founded by members of the medical community, who saw the need for these supportive services and then just volunteered their time. But over the years, we have grown to now we are a 501c3. We have 80 staff and a $7.5 million budget, so we have come a long way.
Wow.
And we provide a whole variety of services now, all supportive. We're not medical, but a full array of supportive services.
Part of that, the change of the services that are provided, you still are very much on that level of, for some people, of their most basic needs.
Absolutely. You know, partly because of the way that the epidemic has changed and the demographics have changed among our clients, so many of our clients live below the poverty level. So we are providing very basic needs like a roof over their heads, food on their tables, and then access to transportation, clothing, and other supportive services.
But the face of AIDS has changed as well, and in one part because people are living with AIDS more than dying from it, even though, yes, people are still dying from it. And then the actual clientele. Tell me how that has changed.
Well, in 1982, when we were founded, I think it was 100% gay men, many of them who were professional and had insurance and other means. But, of course, over the past 22 years, the epidemic has shifted. We still have gay men as clients. However, a large percentage of our clients are persons of color now, heterosexual. And many of our clients are women. A third of our clients are female.
You also have some programs that are specific to children. What are those about?
Now, in terms of our clients that come in for food pantry and things like that, those are the adults, and many of them do have children who receive support via their parent or caregiver. But our children-specific programs are things like our camps, and it was our 10th year for Camp Hope, which is our week-long summer camp for HIV-positive children. We also have Camp Hug, which is a family camp, a weekend camp, and any member of the family can be infected, and then the family comes to camp and enjoys that. But the other thing that we are about to start that I'm very excited about is next June we will be launching our Teen Leadership Forum. And this program has come out of the fact that children who were born with HIV are surviving. And when we founded camp 10 years ago, in many ways we thought it would almost be like a make-a-wish situation, that this would be just a chance for the kids to go to camp once in their lives. But thanks to the advent of medications and effective treatment, these children are surviving. And what we're finding is that they are aging out of camp. They are about to be graduating high school, launching their own lives, and we felt like they might not be completely prepared for that. They needed some additional assistance in terms of learning about their illness, learning about how to care for their own medical needs, advocate for themselves. And then, frankly, there are a lot of issues that they have to confront that have to do with dating, relationships, and sexuality. And so through our Teen Leadership Forum, we're going to help them with these issues and also get them thinking about college or career.
Can you imagine what that's like, going off to college and having a whole new group of people that you're meeting, and one of the things you're going to have to tell them if you're really going to live your life honestly is that you have HIV?
Isn't that the truth? I can't imagine a harder time of life than adolescence, and that's without HIV, but to have this illness on top of it, it's a major challenge for those teens.
And, of course, in a way, though, it's a victory because several years ago, a decade ago, they would have never even made it to college. So
absolutely. I'd rather them be facing these issues than succumbing to this illness. So we're glad to be able to provide this service beginning next June.
Now, Kelly, you are a clinical psychologist?
I worked as an associate clinical psychologist. It was my first job out of graduate school in the Texas prison system. And after working there for a few years, moved to Houston and was still in mental health. But then in the mid-90s, I decided that I needed to do a career change and make HIV my focus.
And so you went to work with the Montrose Counseling Center.
Started out, that's right. Deborah, you and I are our former colleagues
veteran
there.
Survivors,
that's right.
Of
Montrose Counseling Center. I went to work there in 1996, really starting out in a pretty entry-level position because I wanted to learn about this disease, this industry, and I started out as an educator, HIV educator, and worked at Montrose Counseling for 5 years.
And you also had a title of criminal justice liaison. I love that word, liaison. It's
it does
French.
Sound, yes, it does sound very exotic.
But was that, did that come about because of your previous work in the prison system?
You know, my family, my mom in particular, we joke about, I think I've spent more time in prison than many offenders over the years. And
yeah, I remember a few weeks ago when I invited you to come on the program, you said, well, I'm going to be in prison that day. And I said, well, Kelly, that's really amazing that you can be in prison and run the AIDS Foundation.
Yes, that's right. Telecommuting does wonders. I think it was a logical next step. Just to give you a little background, in 1997, the San Antonio Light newspaper issued a series of scathing articles about how the Texas Department of Criminal Justice was not addressing HIV adequately or HIV prevention. And so Ann Robison, who is executive director over at Montrose Counseling Center, she saw that that was a population with a high number of needs. And so we talked, and given my background, she asked me to begin working on setting up some case management and education programs within certain units in the Houston area. And we had a very successful program, and I believe it is still in place over at Montrose Counseling Center now.
And then in 2001, you moved over to AIDS Foundation Houston as Vice President of Community Resources.
That is right. As a matter of fact, I met Mike Mizwa, who is the former CEO of AFH. I met him in prison. AFH was also doing a little bit of prison work, and so we met, and when the opportunity arose, Mike became CEO. I was fortunate enough to be able to step into his position and take over prevention and volunteer services at AFH, and a huge part of that has been a program that we call Wall Talk, and it's a three-year program funded by HRSA.
I talk to walls a lot.
Bang my head against them. But this is a peer education program that's based in the Texas prisons where we go in, and either AIDS Foundation Houston staff or one of our community partners, we go in and actually train offenders to be health educators, and then they in turn conduct classes on their units. And we have, over the past 3 years, trained approximately 900 offenders who in turn have educated literally thousands upon thousands of their fellow offenders about HIV and other infectious diseases.
You know, just earlier, we've asked for the president and the vice president to resign. And
where do I sign the petition?
Yeah, well, as we talk about that, what are the challenges of funding?
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up because it's not just right now, but for a while. We have seen that funding is not adequate to meet the need.
And to add on that, there was a really interesting editorial in the New York Times recently about Uganda, where they were actually making some real progress in HIV and AIDS, and they were doing that by the use of condoms.
Exactly.
And this government feels that they have the right to make the decision of giving money to these organizations, but giving the caveat that condoms cannot be used.
Absolutely. That is the mantra, I think, of our current administration. Abstinence only, despite the fact that condoms save lives and prevent the transmission of this illness. You know,
they don't issue condoms in prison, though.
No, no condoms in prison. What we are allowed to do is couch everything in this is a free world basis. And so we talk about condoms. We can't bring them in for demonstration, but we draw pictures. We're very creative in how we can educate the offenders about the condom use. But, you know, getting back to what you were talking about, Jack, the funding situation is bad and could become worse. One issue is that, as you mentioned earlier, Deborah, thankfully people are living longer with HIV. So what that means, though, is that there are greater and greater numbers of people on the rolls who need assistance. However, the funding from the government is not increasing. It's flat or decreasing. Add to that, we have 40,000 plus new infections in this country every year. So you can see the pool of people who are going to have needs for services is just growing and growing, and the funding is not keeping up at all.
Has the AIDS Foundation been involved with our current crisis in helping the survivors of Katrina?
Very proud to say that, yes, we've been able to assist a fairly significant number of people. Like Montrose Clinic, we were opened over the Labor Day weekend, and we have been providing housing. You know, housing is one of the core competencies of AIDS Foundation Houston. We have numerous housing programs that we operate ourselves, and then we also have rent and utility mortgage assistance programs. And happy to report that through those programs, we were actually able to provide housing for Katrina evacuees. We're still working with them. We had a table set up right next to medical triage at the George R. Brown, and we're still there. And that's been a real help in trying to access the evacuees who need housing. And then I have to just really put...
And these are evacuees who have HIV.
Who have HIV, yeah. Thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, we provide housing to people living with HIV or AIDS.
That's got to be just such a horror story. I mean, what these people went through is just incredibly a terrible thing. But then, if you're HIV on top of that, being in with first of all, being in New Orleans when everything went bad, not having food, not even having sanitary conditions, and then having to be packed in with everybody else, and then being transport it to somewhere you don't even know where you're going. And from what I, you know, to try to look at it objectively, it looks like Houston in many ways did a fabulous job, and the organizations just seem to all work together, although certainly, you know, there's probably some concerns about the bureaucracy of the people, you know, being separated from their families and stuff like that, but it looked like Houston did a fabulous job.
And what are the evacuees doing about getting their medications?
Well, luckily through Montrose Clinic and Thomas Street Clinic, they've been able to help the evacuees access meds as well as medical care. And you know, I've been so proud to be a Houstonian over the past couple of weeks, not only in because of the way the entire city has responded, but in our field, in the community services arena, and especially those HIV agencies, we have really come together. You know, sometimes there's some territoriality out there amongst certain community-based organizations, but all of that has been put aside, and rightfully so. And we've seen everybody really coming together to help these people at a severe time of crisis. And that's another reason I've been very, very proud to be a Houstonian.
It makes me feel like I should have on angel wings, you know.
Well, there's certainly let's get some for you. But there are a whole lot of folks out there that deserve wings this week.
Yeah, and certainly it's something we can learn from. And thank God it's something, or whoever. That's funny for an atheist to say, thank God. But whatever your higher power is, that it's something that we can say that. We can learn from it because, you know, should something like that happen here, we want to be way more prepared and will be, I'm sure.
Well, you know, kind of like you said, the early days of the HIV epidemic, we were making it up as we were going along. That's what's happened in terms of the response to this crisis. And we've learned some things. There are some things that we won't repeat in the future. But overall, I think the response has been just top-notch.
It's been amazing. It really has for the short period of time, and just everyone. And like you said, agencies put aside differences and work together, and that happened on the county and city levels and bipartisanship and everything.
And just as we saw so many people come out and volunteer that the past couple weekends, which is fabulous, there are needs that continue. So for somebody who has volunteered or maybe felt that maybe this wasn't the right time or they want to continue on volunteering, can they do that at the AIDS Foundation?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you bring that up because that's something we've been talking about around the office, is that this is not a sprint, this is a marathon. And these evacuees are going to be with us for months. And it is great to see everybody come together and volunteer and make donations right here at the beginning, but it is our hope that we'll continue to see those kinds of gifts of their time and their pocketbooks over the next several months. But please, we need any and all volunteers at AIDS Foundation.
So where does the funding come from?
Well, in terms of the housing, we've been very fortunate. HOPWA, which is Housing Opportunities for Persons with HIV/AIDS, we have gotten approval to get people into housing first. And that's, you know, that's a philosophy, housing first, because until you have a secure place to stay, all other needs are really secondary, such as medical care, et cetera. So we've been able to operate under that housing first philosophy of getting these individuals into housing, and then at least for 30 days, then we'll be able to assess what their needs are and find other sources of support for them. But right now, early on, we've been able to use existing funding sources, but I know for many other services, we're relying upon donations, you know, to buy furnishings or household goods and things like that that HOP was not paying for. So it's a combination of federal and private funding at this point.
But also the ongoing needs of the AIDS Foundation, Houston, and the current clientele that you have, the needs, where do you draw your funds and what's in place, what fundraising mechanisms are in place?
Well, you know, like many organizations, federal grants are probably the biggest bulk of our funding, and then we have private foundations that grant us money, as well as private fundraisers, like our AIDS Walk. That's our biggest fundraiser every year. March 13th, 2006, downtown. I'll be hopefully invited back before then to remind everybody of that. But there's one other thing that we are starting, that, and it's very timely that we're talking about it.
If not you, Alyssa.
Yes. we are a National AIDS Fund partner, and just to give everybody a little background, National AIDS Fund is a national funding organization that the Elton John AIDS Foundation, that's the only American foundation that they give money to, and they ask then that NAF, National AIDS Fund, distribute that money as it is needed across the country. And so NAF selects certain cities to be partners, and AIDS Foundation Houston is the partner for Houston. And what we do is we receive money from NAF, and then we raise money, a 2-to-1 match, as a matter of fact. We raise funds to match that, and then we grant it back out to the community for prevention programs. And this year, we are launching a fundraising mechanism called Makuru, and it is an art series. It's combining arts with AIDS, and it is going to be a series of concerts and other visual and cultural arts performances that we will utilize to raise money to create that NAF match that will allow us to continue funding prevention programs. And in particular, we are targeting prevention programs that are for sexual and racial minorities. And that's one of the ways that we continue to give back to the gay community here.
Yeah, I think we have to remind people every time that AIDS is something that you almost have to try to get these days. If you have the proper information, if you practice safer sex, if you don't use HIV drugs, the behaviors, I'm sure, is what part of what goes into what you do in the prison system.
You're right.
You change behaviors.
It is behavior-based.
Prevention, boy, that just helps all the way around.
You know, it's scary, though, especially among youth. You will hear them say, you know, I don't want HIV, but if I get it, I'll just take the meds. And that gives me cold chills, that kind of complacency.
Yeah.
Because, yes, I'd rather us prevent HIV in the first place, and then you don't ever have to worry about your meds or your health in that way. So a part of our prevention program is, of course, try and get the message out, especially to the youth, that this is something you want to avoid.
Do you think they think that way in part because we have been so successful in what we've done to this date?
Or the fact that they don't know of all the people we lost who are a little bit older.
Exactly. It's like when my kids were younger, they were around people who were dying of AIDS, and they saw what that was like, and they got the message early on, and it made them be much more responsible. So is it because they don't know?
I think part of it is that they did not live through the 80s and attend weekly funerals and see the devastation that this illness caused to people that they loved. That's part of it. I think the advent of medications is part of it, because people with HIV can and do lead healthy, long, productive lives. And then I think media as well. I mean, to open up a magazine and look at a pharmaceutical ad, and it shows somebody with HIV climbing a mountain, and a good-looking buff guy, too. It's like, hey, yeah, I can look like that and have HIV. Sure, why why not? So I think all those factors have really contributed to this attitude of complacency.
It's like those commercials for the herpes pill, and it's like this woman is, you know, she's on a sailboat and she's on a horse, and I'm like, boy, you know, get herpes, have a good time.
Yeah, have a lot of recreational activities.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we know the reality is not like that. Now, this fundraising the concert and art series, Mukuru,
yes.
Now, what does that mean? Where does that come from?
Mukuru is the name of a benevolent African deity, a god of compassion. And Mukuru is the god that takes care of his children when they're sick, helps them be healed, provides them water, and even is seen as benevolent when he takes them home to heaven in death. And we just thought that whole message of compassion was something
so
that was perfect.
So you wouldn't have, like, a picture next to him equal George Bush?
No, that would not be.
This would be what are opposites.
That's right. Mukuru is compassionate, and we are, as a matter of fact, if you go to www.mukuru.org, and Mukuru is M-U-K-U-R-U, you'll see an entire list of the concert series we have coming up. The first one is this month, Sunday, September the 25th, but there are a variety of events that span all the way into next spring. And, you know, this is the first time for AIDS Foundation Houston to link up the arts community with social justice. And so we're very excited about this.
Who are the people doing the concert?
It's a variety.
You're getting up there with a banjo? Nancy Ford? what is this?
Hey, Nancy might be one that we can ask to do this, but this is cultural arts. So what we have are members of the Houston Symphony, quartets. Many of the performances are smaller scale, quartets or soloists, a dance company. So, yeah, this is not your typical Wednesday night at Chance's kind of live mic or something like that. This is
we're talking culture here.
This is class, Deborah.
You're right. I have to get out the little black dress.
That's right. Well, you bring the dress. Well, I'll be in the black suit.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to share with us about AIDS Foundation Houston before you leave us, Kelly?
Well, just always want to remind the community that we are there if they have needs. If it's not a service that we can provide them, we have a wide network of resources and would happily make referrals. And just want to thank y'all for what you do in bringing the community's attention to various issues and allowing organizations like AFH to come on and talk about what's going on in our world. So just remember, everybody, we're there. And you can visit our website at www.aidshelp.org.
AIDSHELP.org. And phone number?
713-623-6796.
Thank you very much, Kelly McCann from AIDS Foundation Houston.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Oh,
And that was Beautiful World by Holly Light, another of the artists who will be joining us in Houston at the Houston Women's Festival on September 25th.
It was an amazing high, annihilated all too quickly by an infuriating low. California's Democrat-controlled state legislature on September 6th became the first in the U.S. to pass a marriage equality bill, AB 849, only to have a spokesperson for Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger announce less than 24 hours later that he would veto it. Openly gay state assembly member Mark Leno of San Francisco steered his bill through the chamber, seeking four more votes than the measure had originally received there before being approved by the state Senate. And it passed the second time, following emotional debate with the bare number required. Assembly member Mark Leno.
Why would we want our government involved in the most intimate and personal decision-making process of our life? Get government out of our personal and heartfelt decision-making. I ask for your iVote.
Orange County Democrat Tom Umbergs was one of those key swing votes.
Since I abstained on the last vote, I've been cajoled, been harassed, been harangued, and been threatened. And those are my friends communicating with me. This is one of those times when history looks upon us to see where we are. 10 years from now, very few of us will recall even those who we served with. 10 years from now, even fewer of us will recall the bills that were voted upon. But 10 years from now, there are a handful of issues that history will record where we stood, and this is one of those issues.
San Diego area Republican Jay LeSueur led the debate against the bill.
I don't want to sit down and have to explain to my little grandboys that's okay. It's all right. That's perfectly normal, because it's not. It is not. It is not okay. Not one religion in the world, not one moral, ethical value in the world says it's okay. The people of California said it is not okay. The people of the state of California, those that you represent,
LeSueur was referring to Proposition 22, passed overwhelmingly by California voters 5 years ago, defining marriage as between one man and one woman. Advocates for Leno's bill maintained that the language of Proposition 22 only bans legal recognition of same-gender marriages performed in other states. Concluding his assembly debate, Leno talked about that so far only state.
In the state of Massachusetts, just in the 15 months since marriage licenses have legally been issued to loving and committed same-sex couples, popular support has gone from 40 to 62%.
So Leno, 20 seconds.
And that is why our opposition is so adamant that this not happen, because the very fact of it proves that the sky does not fall, that civilization as we know it does not come to an end, and the loving couple down the block who just got their marriage license, whether it's Jackie and Sharon or somebody else we know and care about, did not destroy your heterosexual marriage.
The deciding vote was cast by Democrat Simon Salinas from the conservative Northern California area of Salinas. Notable political courage for someone who plans to run against a conservative senator next year. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, who presided over thousands of same-gender marriages last year until the state Supreme Court stopped him, says he regrets Governor Schwarzenegger's veto statement and is not surprised by it. But
it disappoints me greatly, and it's going to disappoint literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of San Franciscans, and for that matter, millions of people across the country. The governor had a unique and rare opportunity in life to stand up on principle and to stand up on the foundation of our Constitution and advance civil rights, and he decided to duck it. He decided not to take the opportunity to do the right thing. He made the politically expedient choice of placating a base in the context of an election year. So obviously I'm disappointed, but no one's more disappointed than the tens of thousands of couples and their extended and immediate families that won't have the same rights and privileges that Maria Shriver and Arnold Schwarzenegger have been afforded and frankly have, I think, taken for granted. By no means was this a profile in courage. I'm just sad with politics and politicians today, but boy, I'm proud of those 41 people that put their careers on the line in the legislature. This is real. This is about basic fundamental rights. It's about laying a foundation of equality for everybody. You guys will make the political calculus. I want to put the human face on this, and the human faces were the 4,000 couples and their brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, fathers, sons, and daughters that are affected by this decision. And it's not just the people in the state of California. This would have had an extraordinary impact on this debate across this country and around the world.
San Francisco couple John Lewis and Stuart Gaffney were in the gallery for the historic passage of AB 849 in the state legislature, and less than 24 hours later, they were at one of the first demonstrations in the state to protest Schwarzenegger's threatened veto.
When he became the governor, I remember that day he took the oath of office, and he said he would be the governor for all Californians. And he made a promise. He said, "I will not forget you." And today, he forgot Stuart and me, 18 years together as a family, and he forgot thousands of other loving same-sex couples and families who simply want the same rights and protections and recognition for their relationships that everybody else has. I really want to ask the governor, where is your heart? Did you check your heart? Because this issue is about love. And the debate last night in the legislature, all the people who spoke in favor of equality, they talked so personally. And because it is so personal, it's about our lives. The gallery was filled with same-sex couples, LGBT people, our supporters, our allies, and we heard the eloquent speeches, and then it came time to vote. And the truth of the lives of lesbian and gay people, same-sex couples, and our friends, our families, our moms, our dads, our grandparents, grandchildren, the truth of our lives is becoming revealed to the public. But something happened a year and a half ago. Stuart and I, San Francisco City Hall, we made a vow to one another, and that was to be together and to overcome anything, and took vows for better or for worse. And a community has taken a collective vow for better or for worse. And so we and our allies in this entire community, we have determination, and there's just no stopping. There's no stopping us. We know what equality feels like now, and we're never going back.
Assemblymember Mark Leno, lead sponsor of AB 849, critiqued Schwarzenegger's veto statement during an interview on KCBS Radio in San Francisco.
This is highly uncommon for the governor to make a definitive decision prior to the bill even getting to his desk. It's not even there yet. It's in the, on the enrollment desk, which is a process between the legislature and the governor's office. The only conceivable explanation for moving so quickly, if in fact it's true, and I say if, would be he's politically pandering to the far right. But for a governor who has repeatedly chastised the legislature for sitting around and doing nothing, we have picked up one of the most important issues of the day, held public hearings, had public debate, and then taken a vote in favor of marriage equality. So we've done our job. If he just wants to punt, if it's true that that's what he's going to do, he's certainly not doing his job.
Schwarzenegger's veto rationale, saying the bill goes against the will of the people, has prompted its authors to delay delivering it to him, hoping to give equality advocates several days to phone and email protests in a last-ditch effort to win his support. The governor has said he supports the will of the people, said State Senator Sheila Kuehl, a Santa Monica Democrat and one of the legislature's six openly queer members. Well, let the people call him, let the people email him, let the people be heard. Then he can say he's following the will of the people. Reporting for This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
I think there's a queer sensibility, and I think that all sorts of people have it. I have known straight people with a queer sensibility. They're such outsiders that they create art because of it. I think my own internal life as a young queer is the reason that I'm a storyteller. Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of The Night Listener, and you are listening to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
This Way Out listener, Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Dayton, Ohio, in honor of his mother, Mabel Simmons, has issued a donor matching challenge to supporters of this program. Please check out the new information on our website, www.thiswayout.org, to see how your help to keep This Way Out on the air will mean twice as much to us. Thank you.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky, Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, and Glenn Holt.
And Deborah Bell.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
From Cincinnati, one of the finest women's choruses in the country, and our guest tonight brought that CD, I guess both kind of an inspiration for what they're aspiring to do, and also because they're going to do that song at one of their future performances. Welcome.
Welcome, Angela Pezzaretti and Flo Perry with the Women's Chorus of Houston. Now, does it have an official name?
It does.
And that is?
The Bayou City Women's Chorus.
That's right. I couldn't remember. Bayou City Women's Chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And you're the sister organization to the Gay Men's Chorus of Houston, which is rehearsing tonight.
That's right.
And you have a rehearsal. Is it a rehearsal or just a meeting tomorrow night?
Oh, no. It is our first weekly rehearsal.
First?
So we are kicking it off.
Rehearsal.
You betcha.
Now, is it too late for someone to join if they haven't already?
No, it absolutely isn't. As a matter of fact, we've got five open rehearsals. We start with next week, and we are tomorrow night, excuse me, and we go all the way through Tuesday, October 18th. So we want anybody who's interested to come and check it out and see what a rehearsal feels like and what it's like to be directed by James Knapp, who is very, very talented, and then make a decision.
What kind of a time commit would this be for someone?
Well, the rehearsal schedule itself is every Tuesday night, and that's a given. That's just every Tuesday, 7 to 10 p.m. at Resurrection Metropolitan. I never can say it right. MC.
It used to be MCCR,
RMCC. So that's where they will practice in the chapel. So that will be the primary commitment until we get close to when the performances begin, and then there will be some additional practices. But that's down the road a bit. So the first piece of commitment is the Tuesday night, 7 to 10 p.m.
Is there a first performance lined up?
It's on the books that we will probably have the women singing with the men, one or two songs, whatever, at the holiday concert.
That's a very logical first step.
Right. And then their breakout concert will be in June, and that, mm-hmm. That will be their own first standalone. So we're pretty excited about June coming up.
It takes that many months before you're ready to even do a public performance.
It'll
huh?
be here before you know it.
Well, the thing too, we will do the women's chorus the same way we do the men. We strive for excellence in all performances, and I think that the thinking is that a first performance just can't leave anything to be desired. It's got to be perfection, or people are going to, you know, you just get one first impression. So we really want to make sure that we kick off with everything we've got.
Now, Flo, you're on the board of directors.
That's correct.
And that is that for both choruses, for the whole organization?
Right. That's exactly right. The BioCity Performing Arts is the umbrella organization that houses the two choruses, the Gay Men's Chorus and the Women's Chorus, the BioCity Women's Chorus. And they share the infrastructure for this 26-year old organization. So this is a growth project out of that organization. And so, yes, they share the board and they share everything else. They share the revenue and the expense.
Now, I understand that you sing, but you are currently a little too overbooked to be in the chorus this year, but plan to next time. Had you been involved with a chorus before?
Oh, as a young person, I sang almost from the time I was 6 or 7. So I've been singing most of my life, but have quit for a number of years, given that my career took precedence over anything that was more like fun. So.
Oh, what could be more important than singing? I mean, if I could sing, that's all I'd do.
Well, you know, it's a story that we hear from a lot of the women who are joining the chorus, that that singing has been an important part of their lives, but many of us got kind of detoured, I guess. We know that several women were a part of Heart Song, and women have been a part of church choirs and sung in colleges, etc., and are just so excited to be coming back and to have a group to sing with.
And Heart Song being a women's chorus that was very lively here for mm-hmm. a number of years in mm-hmm. Houston. One of my favorite things that Heart Song did was when they would do their amateur night.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of, it was kind of like a variety show more
right.
than just
right.
chorus performances. So it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of people that were in Heart Song, but it's not the same group.
Oh, no. No, it couldn't be the same group.
Right.
I mean, even the people that were in it, we are all different people. We are older, certainly, and we've changed. The world has changed. But we carry a wonderful memory of what it's like to sing with a group of women. And, you know, in my opinion, there's just nothing like it. So we're ready to just to build on that and build something new and wonderfully different.
So what do we have to look forward to?
Well, let me see. I can give you just a hint of what we might be performing. That's right. That's right. Just dangle this carrot. I understand that we're going to be singing, as J.D. said, Music in My Mother's House, which many of us are familiar with and love. We're going to be singing some really kind of fun stuff, too. Carole King's Tapestry album, some of the things from there. We remember Carole King, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Us baby boomers. We're also going to be singing some pieces that have been arranged by a woman from the Dallas Women's Chorus named Ann Albritton, and one of them is Ain't No Mountain High Enough, which is going to be fun. How Can I Keep From Singing, which is a more traditional piece, and then for people who are interested in more of the quote-unquote serious music, we'll be singing something from the Songs of Sanctuary by Carl Jenkins. It's a large choral work for women's voices. The European classical tradition, but it sounds almost more like ethnic music, world music. So it's going to be quite a variety.
I have a question from a personal bias. Are you considered anything lyrically lesbian?
Lyrically lesbian? Tell me what you mean by lyrically lesbian.
Songs about women.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, our director, James Knapp, has been networking with women's choruses mm-hmm. for the last 6 months or so. And so he, I'm sure, has been privy to some of the best mm-hmm. music and some wonderful coaching and advice from Seattle Women's Chorus, from the Women's Chorus of Dallas, and, of course, one of our favorites, Muse, from Cincinnati. Yes. And another thing that's interesting about our group is that people are submitting music to James to listen to, and we all have our favorites, and he's been wonderfully open to that and is really looking forward to really growing himself as a musician and as somebody working with women.
About how many women's choruses are there in this country?
God, you asked that question before, and I didn't know it.
And you still don't know it. You didn't know it.
I didn't know it then, and I should have been prepared, shouldn't I?
Well, I think J.D. has some experience.
What would you say, 10?
Oh, I would say more than that.
More than 10.
Oh,
so,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because there's a group gala.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Courses,
right.
And they have a website, and you could
right.
go to that and just kind of pick them out. But,
right.
I've been in organizations that have had music awards over the years, like Out Music,
mm-hmm.
and there's categories for choruses.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been women's groups in it every year from all over the country and elsewhere, Australia, so forth.
That's exciting.
And just think, someday, very soon, Bayou City Women's Chorus could be featured on JD's syndicated.
You gotta have a CD.
Gotta have a CD. All right. Well, we'll work on that.
We'll work on that.
That's doable. We will work on that.
That's
yeah.
Doable.
And while we're on the subject, though, I would like to stress that this is a women's chorus, all women, all inclusive. So while there will be certainly a large number of lesbians singing, we do open the chorus to all women, and we have non-lesbian women participating at this and point. And that's okay.
Well, you know, right. one of the things that we really want is a diverse group, because there's such richness and beauty in a diverse group.
I think a lot of the women's choruses have that same philosophy,
mm-hmm.
where it's not a lesbian chorus, it's
right.
a women's chorus.
Exactly.
But they do sing songs for women.
You bet. Okay. Songs for women and songs for lesbians and songs.
Or feminist songs.
Songs on yeah, themes that pertain to women's
mm-hmm.
lives and that are important to women. And I think what we're also clear about is that this chorus is going to be a place where lesbians can feel safe and welcome and wanted, as well as heterosexual women, people of various races, ages, abilities, physical abilities. It's for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And how do you decide what music to do? You have an artistic director, but
mm-hmm.
is that the bottom line, or is there some kind of democratic
or do
process?
Do you vote, or what?
Yeah.
We have an artistic director, and he
don't
is.
Vote.
We don't vote.
And we don't
but
vote.
He is, however, open to listening to the songs and the ideas that other people have, but when it's time to make the program happen, James Knapp will decide, and he will have the ultimate vote on that.
Mm-hmm.
The board will support him, but he is that is his charge, to take care of the artistic piece of the organization.
How long have y'all been meeting now, Angela?
What was our first meeting? Was it October?
Mm.
November? It's been almost a year.
I thought we didn't start
wow.
till early in the year. I thought it was like.
Maybe that's when the task force got
yeah,
together.
I think somewhere.
Yeah, I think the first meeting that was an open meeting where we actually started recruiting was January.
It's mm-hmm. somewhere in that, because the
yeah.
task force went to work late last year, and I headed that up for
right.
several months before we decided to go forward with this.
Right.
And then we started meeting in small groups. And our first meeting was 12 people, and mm-hmm. I was elated. I thought that was so good. And then by the time we got to, June, we
mm-hmm.
were getting, you know,
we've got over 100 women on the roster
100?
Who've expressed interest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Some are volunteers, because we have a lot of openings for volunteers
right.
to manage a large organization like this.
So what would you guess the singing portion or
probably
be?
We only probably have 10 volunteers at best, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm thinking it's probably anywhere from 50 to 80
that are
able
to
sing.
Start.
Well, we're
awesome.
Certainly hoping everybody comes to
yeah,
sing at that
right.
first rehearsal tomorrow
right.
night.
That's what
okay,
I'm looking forward
and again,
to.
Again, if they want to get in touch with you to find out more and
mm-hmm.
the logistics about the rehearsal tomorrow night.
All right. There's several ways to get at us. The one way is certainly to call me, Flo Perry, 713-241-8225.
You can certainly call me or email me. My email address is Passaretti, PASSARETTI, at sbcglobal.net, and I respond pretty promptly to emails, and we've got flyers we can send you and just some basic information, but we should say where people should show up tomorrow night.
Right, I agree. I think tomorrow night you don't even need to talk to anyone if you're
just
listening.
Show
and
up.
Just show up.
You bet.
Walk in the door. We will welcome you so much. You just cannot imagine how much we want you to be
there.
Is there
a website yet for the course?
There is a website. If you type in gmch.com, which is the gay men's chorus.com, there is
a section for you.
Yeah, for BCWC, but it's very small because we have not really started. But there's just enough information to give you an address and names.
The rehearsal is at what time?
7 to 10 p.m.
7 to 10 p.m. The Resurrection Metropolitan Church at West T.C., Jester, and 11th Street.
That's right. Just south of the bayou on 11th Street.
And all it's right. in the chapel, so go right to the mm-hmm. the sanctuary and through to the chapel.
Well, the small chapel. Jerry and Angela Pazzaretti, thank you so much for talking to us on Queer Voices about the Bayou City Women's Chorus. We look forward to your first performance.
Thank you.
We continue to deal with the disaster that happened in New Orleans, and from what I understand is the response from Houston has been just incredible. And yet, we also have the secondary response from our organizations in the community, and we asked Sally Huffer back, who was with us recently, to talk a little bit about what the Montrose Counseling Center has been doing. And have you been able to get any sleep lately?
I'm promising not to talk about that publicly.
Oh, okay.
'Cause I don't
want didn't ask you who you were sleeping with.
I think it's a false comparison when you find out how hard other people are working.
Understandable.
Sort of thing.
So,
we're all working very hard. So I try to avoid that. But yes, we've all been working very hard. If I could just go over some of the things that we are doing, we do have a guest with us. She's a therapist at the Counseling Center. It's Sherry Syard, and she's one of our therapists. Now, we do have a support group that's meeting twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and we welcome any of the GLBT evacuees to come to Montrose Counseling Center between 11:30 and 1 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. It's at 701 Richmond Avenue, and they can participate in the support group. Now, Sherry isn't the person who facilitates the support group, but she's dealt with a lot of people who have experienced trauma and that sort of thing. So she can talk to us a little bit about what people might be going through and what their expectations might be. But in addition to the support group, we are also putting together a safe homes program. And through this, we are able to match individuals up GLBT evacuees up with people who are willing to open their homes to allow people to come in and get out of the shelter where it may not be the safest place for them to be. So since we started the program, we've had more than 250, probably at this point around 275 people, not just in Houston, but all over the country.
And that's the amazing thing.
That have offered
to house a GLBT or, you know, couple or family that's been displaced by the...
And how many people that have been displaced are seeking services?
Well, it kind of varies. I mean, they kind of trickled in at the beginning of the week, last week, and then more towards the end of the week. It got more critical for us to make some matches. I haven't compared yet how many people. And we've been trying to do some outreach. There's a lot of information out there trying to match the people. And we've got people going to the George R. Brown and going to the Dome and trying to, you know, locate our people and let them know about the services.
I was very interested in that. Was how did you find the, you know, people that identify GLBT in order to let them know these services were available?
Well, I can tell you the first person that I was in contact with was from a shelter in LaPorte, and there was a woman that had dropped off some clothing to donate to the shelter in LaPorte, and she had overheard somebody commenting that he was being harassed by the other shelter residents because he was gay. Now, she wasn't familiar with our program just yet, but she did go home, get on the computer. She felt like there had to be something to help this individual. And so she found us on the web, and we were able to contact the Red Cross, contact the specific shelter, which was in a church. And I have to be real careful and clear that this kind of harassment that a lot of people are experiencing is not institutional. It is not from the volunteers of the Red Cross.
It's the other people they evacuated with.
Exactly. And so, in fact, we've had nothing but a positive response from the Red Cross and from the various shelters in my being able to send them flyers to post at the various locations, because it does ease overcrowding if we can get somebody out of that shelter and into a safe place. So that was the first, you know, person that we encountered that was experiencing some shelter, and that was the Thursday or Friday right after it happened. So we've had a really good response from them. And then, of course, we're out there with flyers every day trying to locate people. There's been information if people have internet access, they can look on. There's been articles about it on 365gay.com, Planet Out, The Advocate. So we've been getting a lot of coverage there.
And I hear that you're even featured in This Way Out segment.
I didn't know that I was. How exciting.
Which we'll be playing next after this interview.
So we've been able to get the word out. If people are listening, we know that some people were still able to listen to their satellite radios. So we had some coverage there. And so there's been information, of course, in our wonderful gay press, the Houston Voice, TXT News Magazine, and at the Outsmart website. We've been working closely with the community center. We've been working closely with another, a number of community groups, so that if anybody encounters somebody that's going through a difficult time, that we're able to somehow get in touch with them and try to place them in a safe home.
And I know I was contacted by lesbians who live elsewhere in the country who said, we want to do something, but we want to do it for lesbians. And I contacted Sally and I said, will this be taken into consideration? And she said, by all means, if there's a lesbian, she wants to be housed in a lesbian household, we will work to make that happen.
Well, and the same is true for the homeowner. For them to open their homes and allow somebody to come into their homes, they do have a right to have a preference. If they only want to welcome somebody into their home that is lesbian or gay or transgender or bisexual. But I got to tell you, most of the people that I've spoken with, now if they do express a preference, they might say, well, I would prefer a lesbian, but I will accept anybody that's in need. So, I mean, the outpouring of concern and compassion, like I said, from Houston and all over the country and in Canada. And one of the great parts about that is that we heard from somebody the other day whose business had business offices in Michigan. And so he was headed to Michigan thinking, you know, I can already start my life over and at least have the possibility of transferring my job if I can find somebody in Michigan. Well, we went back to our database, and sure enough, there was somebody in the exact city in Michigan that had said that they'd be willing to open their doors, and so we were able to connect the people together. I do want to say, though, that what we're providing is just a matching service. We're not doing criminal background checks. The way it works is that we take the information from the evacuee, a way to contact that person. We do a real quick assessment of them. Are they a smoker? Do they have pets? How many are in their party? Are they G, L, B, or T? That sort of thing. We try to match them up with someone, and then we give their contact information to the homeowner. And then we let the homeowner contact the evacuee so that they can do any additional screening that they would feel necessary in order to feel like this person was suitable to come into their household.
And how many people have been matched up so far?
I don't know.
You know, those numbers are always so important.
I know
we like numbers here.
I know that right before I got on the radio, I took a message. So as soon as we get out of here, I have to go back and see if I can find a home for this person. And it's getting late at night. So if you're in the database, you might get a phone call.
Uh-huh.
Well, and let's talk about some of the needs and some of the conditions that these people have been through.
Well, specifically, I was more interested in talking about the fact that people's lives have been so disorganized that it makes it difficult to pinpoint exactly where you need to begin, which would be beginning at the physical need level. Are they getting enough food? Are they getting water? Are they getting shelter? That kind of thing. I think another thing to look at is what Sally spoke about and the double sensitivity of not being treated well in shelter, because that double victimizes someone. And so for organizations to be profoundly careful about treating people equally and being careful to monitor that kind of thing, I think will help a lot of people not get double whammied by what has happened. Because there's more than double whammy. There's multiple losses at so many levels. Loss of home, loss of occupation, loss of pets, loss of friends, loss of family. But there's also just the loss of maybe a loss of faith in the universe.
And loss of your sense of what is home. I know I was away for about 9 months. I was in D.C. working on a project. And when I came back across the Texas border, I burst into tears because it's home to me, you know. And losing what you know, and especially knowing that in so many ways, a lot of people will never be able to go back there. That home does not exist as they know it, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a real heartbreak. So, when I talked to Sue Lovell on Friday, she was saying we're dealing with a lot of heartbroken people.
Sure.
And I thought that was very insightful to express it that way, because that's what it is. And so, Sherry, you're a therapist. That's what you deal with a lot is... Has a support group already taken place?
I know we had one last Tuesday. We were scheduled to have one last Thursday. I don't know, you know, if there were people that showed up for the one on Thursday. So I know that they have. I haven't spoken with people from it. And I can imagine that people are going through, like, a multitude of emotions, not just this sense of loss, but probably, you know, some anger. That would seem pretty...
And the inefficiency sometimes of the system, of people waiting in line for this and then waiting in line for that. I mean, all this talk about having those ATM cards, the debit cards, and then then there was only so many of them.
And the system they had where people were out in the hot sun, and then...
That they don't know where everybody else is. They had, like, no database originally, and I don't know how it's working now, but people were scattered all over the country. It seems like Houston did the best it could and probably a great job, and then having our organizations like the Montrose Counseling Center on top of that work where help, it's just been a great, great thing.
Yep.
I wanted to add something that I think often we talk a lot about what has happened in trauma, and I think it's a really appropriate conversation. But I think also in talking about trauma, there's a fine line between talking about what you can expect and educating, and not, there may be some people who will be able from their strength base to be able to get through this without any really long-term residual trauma.
And there's people that are going to have a delayed reaction.
Absolutely. But I think the most important part, and this is not Pollyannish, and anybody who knows me knows I'm not. So I think the part that's really important is to have an awareness of what trauma will do. Loss of memory, frustration, anger, sadness, all of those things. But I think the important part is for people to understand that what's presented, and I really don't mean this in a very minimizing way, but I think the difference for those people who will be able to accommodate themselves to all of the horrible changes or all of the different changes that came into their life is how they're going to work with it, how they're going to work with what's presented. And so that's going to be the difference between whether someone will be able to make it through all of the drama and all of the frustrations and all of the paperwork and whatever their strength base is or whatever their faith base is or their spirituality, whatever it is, I don't particularly care. Whatever it is, that's what's called on right here, right now for people to focus on as well. And we hear a lot about the problems. And we hear a lot of manifestations about how people will help. But I think if you're looking for a buzzword for trying to help people stay focused, it is focus on what drives you. Focus on how you will work with this in a way that can carry you through.
Well, that really brings up, I mean, it's real easy for us to say, oh, well, call Sally over at the counseling center. I'm so sure she's so glad to hear people say that. Call Sally, and she will work to help you find housing. And then they have the support group. I mean, that's real easy for us just to say that. But what are things that we can do, like when we're hearing someone's story, and what kind of things can we say and to be there for them?
I think the most important part of anybody and working with anybody is listening. Only listening and letting them give space to tell their story, even if they have to tell it 15 times and you've heard it 15 times. It's like with grief and loss. One of the things that happens is people get tired of hearing, and it's not until people can finish working through whatever it is that's troubling them. So the greatest gift we can give to the community out there is to listen, have empathy, provide support.
That's which does not mean the same as finding solutions for people.
Right.
Because sometimes people need that empowerment to discover their own solutions to their dilemma. So, you know, offer that friendly ear.
Yeah.
Listen.
Yeah, and because we want to fix all of this, because we want to make it all better, we need to be very careful around trying to do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people probably just need a sense of validation mm-hmm. for what they're going through. I mean, some people may not see it as traumatic, and that might be delayed, and so they might be saying to myself, how come I don't feel worse about this?
Right, exactly.
I see what everybody's going through, and yet, you know, it's not hit me yet, or maybe it won't hit me. But
well, there's all kinds of scenarios. There's people that left the city early, weren't there when it was really bad with the weather, didn't have to stay in the Superdome, didn't go through that hell, but their house may have been destroyed.
Sure.
Or there's people
they don't know.
They don't know. There's so many people right now that have no idea. Certainly thousands of people that are dealing with the deaths of loved ones, of family, of their community. I remember one woman, I think she was in Biloxi, somewhere on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and she says, that was my church.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll ever be there again. You know, it was a big part of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And she was taking pieces of the stained glass window. You know? We just can think of so many of the different kinds of things that have happened and what we're hearing about and the different stories of heroic stories and wonderful stories of help, as well as the, you know, so much of the media has covered of the really bad stories. In this community, we were talking with Kelly McCann of the AIDS Foundation earlier about the needs of the people with HIV and AIDS. Is that also something that the counseling center is having to deal with?
Sure. Certainly anybody who is HIV positive can come to Montrose Counseling Center and receive HIV counseling, or they can access our case management services. But case management services have also been opened up to anybody from the evacuated area who is GLBT. So normally we would provide case management services only to those affected by HIV. But now, because of what's happened, we are trying to do assessments when we send people out to the various different areas and find out. Come into the counseling center and meet with a case manager and let's talk about what your needs are. You know, as Sherry was saying, your basic needs, you know, shelter. Even though we can get people into a safe home, that may not be a permanent solution.
So and any gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered person, regardless of HIV status, can access the case management system at Montrose Counseling
right.
Center.
Right, and we can look and see, you know, what are their clothing needs? What are their food needs? Do they have transportation? Do they need bus tokens? So, you know, we're going to go through all
can
of those
Can I give
things.
You the bag of T-shirts I have in my car?
We're not accepting any donations of clothing, unfortunately. So, and one of the things that we were talking about earlier is, you know, the impact, you know, for our transgender community. And, you know, many people have heard about this young woman who was arrested at a shelter in College Station.
She was arrested because she was taking a shower. That's a grievous offense. Of course, she was taking it in what had been designated the women's shower,
right.
And some people, you know, they didn't get it, and there weren't facilities made available to her,
right.
So that she could have that
right.
dignity.
So what we've learned from all of this is that there is a need to educate people at the shelters. So I know that Lambda Legal and the National National Center for Transgender Equality and the Task Force, and all three of their websites now has a downloadable PDF file where it tells people how to be sensitive to the needs of the transgender people in the shelters. Of course, if they call the counseling center, we can try to match them with one of our safe homes and try to get them out of the shelter. But for whatever reason, some people are still choosing to stay in the shelter. This young woman that came to Houston, you know, I don't know if she's come to the counseling center, but we will certainly talk to her about her needs. We need to remember, I mean, one of the things that I had heard was that people were donating makeup, and most of the shades are Caucasian colors, and, you know, we need to be
hair
aware.
Hair products and,
exactly.
and makeup that is for African-American complexions.
And darker complexions,
right.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, especially when we're looking at our transgender community. So you know, those are some of the psychological needs that we need to consider, because this is part of what makes these people human.
Right.
So,
well, let's review about how people can access the Montrose Counseling Center.
Well, right now, if they're interested in the Safe Homes program, I'm asking them to send me an email. And my email address is volunteer@montrosecounselingcenter.org. And that's also our website is www.montrosecounselingcenter.org. There's some flyers there, some more information about our support group that you can download. But if you're interested in the Safe Homes program, I'm going to ask that you email me instead of call, just primarily because of the flood of phone calls that we're getting. And I've already set up a template. I can write you and tell you a little bit more about the Safe Homes program, what information I need from you to enter you into the database. So that's the way I'm asking. But if somebody's interested in participating in the support group tomorrow morning, for example, stop by the counseling center at 11:30, drop in. You don't have to fill out an intake. You don't have to, you know, reserve a spot. Just come to the counseling center at 701 Richmond Avenue.
And Richmond is east of Montrose and west of Maine, I guess you would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can take the light rail if you're
right.
using public transportation and get off at the Richmond Wheeler stop. And we're just a few blocks west.
Number,
I think 25 or 34 buses.
Yeah, 25, Richmond
yeah.
25 bus. But, of course, a lot of people don't have access to email right now. So can they contact through the switchboard, the gay and lesbian switchboard?
Sure, they can do that, too.
And
which
is 713-529-3211.
Okay.
Yay, Jack.
Good. Boy, he's good, isn't he? Okay. Well, Sherry, thank you so much.
My
and
pleasure.
Sally, thank you, as always, for being here on Queer Voices.
Oh, thank you.
This is Queer Voices.
Yes. This way out.
There is a metal rooster down the street at this place that sells architectural.
When Hurricane Katrina touched down on the U.S. Gulf Coast on August 29th, the massive storm cut a trail of destruction over 90,000 square miles and displaced over a million people, among them thousands of gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and trans people who are without homes, supplies, and necessary medications and hormones. Over the past 3 weeks, dozens of GOBT organizations have responded to the crisis, some fundraising for Katrina survivors of all sexual orientations, some specifically lending a hand to people within the communities. This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching has the story of two such organizations.
Hundreds of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgendered people in Houston, Texas, were planning on spending Labor Day weekend partying it up in New Orleans at Southern Decadence. But when Hurricane Katrina hit, they immediately turned their attentions to hosting their displaced brothers and sisters instead. If there's one positive story to come out of Katrina's devastation, it's the massive efforts of LGBT organizations to help members of the community in this time of need.
We were really aware that
Sally Huffer is the community project specialist at Houston's Montrose Counseling Center.
The first thing we did was put together a support group, and our support group is going to be meeting every Tuesday at Montrose Counseling Center from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. So that people can go and talk about what they're going through. Then we realized that there was going to be a shelter crisis. And one of the things that we talked about as a community was that we need to find safe homes for people. We've heard reports of isolated harassment of gay and lesbian individuals who are in the shelters. We try to get to them, make sure that they know we have started a database of safe homes.
Huffer says the counseling center has already matched up a handful of queers with safe homes and adds they already have about 70 more offers of housing from all over North America. But she says more are being gratefully accepted. Huffer anticipates that while demand for homes is low now, it will increase massively in the coming weeks as people run out of money for hotels. Meanwhile, the counseling center's gay and lesbian switchboard has turned into a one-stop referral service, directing people to any other resource they might need in town.
They have a couple of drop-off centers, thanks to Bering Omega Community Services, where people can drop off clothing and non-perishable food items, so people can get things through there. But we're also putting together a case management team where we can help people with bus tokens and gas vouchers and food vouchers and that sort of thing. We also, through Gay and Lesbian Switchboard, we've started a job bank for these people. We've got information and referral for people for their HIV medication. And the Montrose Clinic, as I had mentioned, they can provide medication for people over the hump until the government is able to kick in with not just HIV medication, but if you're diabetic, you're going to need insulin. If you're transgender and you need hormones, you need to get those hormones. And the Montrose Clinic has really stepped up and said, with private donations, and that's all that they're using right now, that's the what they're using to be able to bridge this gap for people until they're able to settle in and get their insurance and all of those things settled.
Gay and lesbian switchboard staff have been doing everything they can to get their phone number into the hands of displaced New Orleans residents. They're in touch with Red Cross workers at the shelters and concierge desks at the hotels, and they've even been making nightly trips to the gay bars to hand out information. Anyone requiring assistance can call the switchboard at 713-529-3211. Anyone interested in donating to the center can visit www.montrosecounselingcenter.org. You can also donate via the Pride Houston Hurricane Relief Fund. Information on that is at www.pridehouston.org. One of the conflicts that queers are often faced with when global disasters strike is that many of the organizations involved in relief efforts are run by conservative Christians with a less than desirable track record on LGBT equality. Organizations like the Salvation Army. This decade, however, has given rise to a new global humanitarian organization run by the queer community.
Rainbow World Fund began in 2000, and it was started by the executive director, Jeffrey Cotter, who's a psychiatric social worker here in San Francisco.
Thomas Shupin speaks for the Rainbow World Fund.
He wanted to take the idea of unification and compassion that came out of the LGBT community in response to the AIDS crisis and extend it to others that were suffering around the world or victims of oppression.
Rainbow World Fund seeks out queer-positive humanitarian organizations who have proven themselves effective managing relief efforts in different parts of the world. It then enters into a partnership with them in which Rainbow World Fund becomes a fundraiser. In the case of Hurricane Katrina,
100% of all of the money from Rainbow World Fund is going to America's Second Harvest, which is the nation's largest food bank network. They work continuously as a food bank network, but in this emergency, they are doing emergency delivery of food and water, food rescue, which is short-term emergency trips, and they're also doing securing warehouse space and helping to take funds to restore some of the food banks that have been destroyed. They've already delivered over 3 million pounds of food and groceries and over 2 million meals, and they've raised over $4 million. And Rainbow World Fund has, within the last few days, raised upwards of $100,000.
Shupin says America's Second Harvest is not a gay and lesbian organization per se, but it is a queer positive one, and it's happy to be in partnership with the Queer Fund. For more information on the Rainbow World Fund or to donate, visit www.rainbowfund.org. Several other funds have also been set up to help queer survivors of Katrina. The National Youth Advocacy Coalition has partnered with around 20 organizations, including the Human Rights Campaign, to create the Hurricane Katrina LGBT Relief Fund. For more information, visit www.nyacyouth.org. And the Houston LGBT Community Center has set up a fund specifically to aid the LGBT Center of New Orleans. To donate to that fund, visit www.hglbtcc.org. For This Way Out, I'm Heather Kitching.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Sherry Lunn, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, and Heather Kitching contributed program material. Thanks also to Christopher Martinez, Molly Page, Sylvester Rivers, J.D. Doyle, Brian Goble, and KCBS Radio in San Francisco. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Don't forget you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Your help to keep this program on the air will now mean twice as much to us. Please log on to thiswayout.org for all the details. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WXPN Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 2XX Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, KPFT Houston, Texas, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Hey, well, we had a double dose of Sally Hubbard tonight because she was featured on This Way Out as well as being live in the studio.
She's international tonight.
I know. And, well, we're back to talking about Christina again, because you know that is
Katrina.
The name. Katrina. Christina. I mixed up with our guest name and made it be the wrong name. Anyway, Katrina and the aftermath that we're dealing with in Houston. And even though our guests tonight are here to talk about a newly formed organization here in Houston, Gay and Lesbian Latin Organization, they're newly formed, but they're already dealing with the issue of the survivors of Katrina. And my guests are Christina Martinez, who is somewhat famous as the publisher of the Rainbow Pages, and Roman Gabriel Delgado. And what are your positions with GAYO?
Well, I am actually the organization's secretary. We will be inducted Thursday at the officer's induction party at EJ's.
Okay, and Roman?
I'm actually the president of GAYO, and again, we will be inducted into office this Thursday.
That sounds so formal, being inducted.
Installed.
Yeah, and GAYO, G-A-L-L-O, is the acronym for Gay and Lesbian Latin Organization, and GAYO means the rooster, for those of you who don't speak Spanish, which I don't, but I want to have a little restaurant in Spring Branch called El GAYO, and a little family-owned restaurant, and
that's
I eat there a lot. Not as often as I'd like to. Building bridges and serving la comunidad.
Comunidad. Which means community.
You know, I guessed as much.
Our executive director, Abel Rodriguez, came up with that saying.
And so tell me what that is about. What's the whole thing behind this?
Well, pretty much what our, like every organization has a mission statement. Well, ours is pretty much just to provide educational forums, financial assistance to the GLBTQ community and its allies. Actually, some members of our organization are our allies, such as heterosexual men and women. But we also have the gays, lesbians, and we're not solely single to the Latino community. I mean, we want to expand.
Everyone is open to join, but your particular mission is to help in the Latina community.
Yes, we feel that we need some more exposure in that sense to bring to light a lot of things, not only in the Latino community, but in other communities as well.
And when do you meet?
We initially, when we started the group, we met almost every week. But after the induction officers, we meet every first Thursday of the month at the Golden Island Buffet Restaurant on Shepherd.
Okay, so people can just show up at what time?
They can show up at 7, but we also have a phone number, which, you know, we will give to y'all, 713-710-0045. What it is pretty much you can leave any contact information in there, and we'll be happy to get back with you.
And your website address?
It's www.houstongayo.org.
And you were just telling me earlier before we came on the air that you're involved in a staffing company that is putting to work GLBT people who are survivors from Katrina.
Yes, we are.
So just a little plug for that.
Okay. I am the staffing manager for a staffing company here. It's called Food Team Houston. They can call the GAYO membership line and leave information there. But pretty much what we do is we find not only temporary staffing, but also permanent placement here in Houston and also in other areas. We're kind of expanding our areas that we have. We have different offices as well.
So it's food and beverage and hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Front and back of the house, banquet servers, bartenders, cooks, so on and so forth.
And we're running short on time, so what are the most important things you would like folks to know about the new organization?
Well, I would like everybody to know that the Latino youth needs an organization like this, but also we're catering to the Black and the Asian. And our elderly, gay and lesbian elderly, have no organizations that cater to them, and we are working on that goal. We would like to invite everybody to join and participate and join us at our officers' induction meeting or party, which is Thursday at EJ's, and get more information from there.
And also, too, we do we don't discriminate within our own community, especially with this organization. So it is open to HIV and AIDS members of our community as well.
Let's give that website again, please.
Yes, it's www.houstongayo.org, or they can reach us at 713-710-0045.
And we want to thank the folks from Gallo for visiting us tonight.
Yeah. Thank you.
That was Neil Sedaka with Where the Boys Are, Do You Believe? And that has nothing to do with me reminding you that next week we'll have folks on from the Houston Women's Festival.
Which is a great festival. We'd like to thank all of our guests tonight, including Sally Huffer from the Montrose Counseling Center.
And also Sherry Shard from the Counseling Center. Kelly McCann from the AIDS Foundation, Houston.
Christina and Gabriel from Gallo.
And Angela Passaretti and Flo Perry with the Bayou City Women's
Did course. We do all that tonight?
I know. It was a mishmash, a masala. But be with us next week for more Queer Voices.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 7 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, and Jack Valensky, with remote correspondents Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. For more information about guests, events, and organizations mentioned in the show, visit queervoices.org. Some of the music you heard is listed or available on J.D. Doyle's website, queermusicheritage.org. Be sure to listen every Saturday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
First,
you listen, then you fall in love. You have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week. And finally, you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today. And when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you.
Be part of a critical effort to combat childhood hunger in Houston. Interfaith Ministries Kids Meals Program provides lunches for low-income children ages 2 to 6 years old. Meals are delivered Monday through Friday by volunteers, and you can help. Become a volunteer driver with Kids Meals, and you can bring food to a child in need. You can deliver on your own or with a group. For more information, please call Catherine Berry at 713-533-4922 or visit the Interfaith Ministries website at imgh.org.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.